Now, there really was no warning. Both Republicans and Democrats were stunned, especially since Trump's own Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, had helped negotiate all this. Yeah. This really put Republicans in a bind. There was a bipartisan consensus that he should sign it, with even some Republicans trying to convince the president, the leader of their own party, that they could seek bigger payments later. Here's Pennsylvania's Pat Toomey, a retiring Republican senator on Fox yesterday.
I understand he wants to be remembered for advocating for big checks, but the danger is he'll be remembered for chaos and misery and erratic behavior if he allows this to expire.
Scott, millions of Americans are still unemployed. People like Charissa Ward. She was furloughed from her job as a server at Disney World in April. Her $275 weekly payments expired on Saturday. And NPR's Michelle Martin spoke to her after that.
Feeling that security blanket is ripped from you, that you have that job that you knew that you could rely on, and it's not there anymore. It takes a lot out of you. I have three kids that I have to try to not make it seem stressful for while I'm at the same time juggling that.
Now, Ward and many others thought they were losing benefits. So what does this bill mean for them?
Well, it does mean these emergency unemployment programs will be extended. But by waiting until Sunday to sign the bill, Trump is interrupting the safety net for millions of people for at least a week. And millions of others are also going to lose a week's worth of supplemental benefits worth $300. So in finally signing the bill, Trump did put out the fire that he himself had started. But a lot of innocent people got burned along the way.
Yeah. So, Scott, how much does this latest round of relief aid help the economy and so many Americans who need help right now?
This is a sizable relief package. You know, $900 billion is more than the Obama administration was able to muscle through Congress with a Democratic majority back at the beginning of the last recession. So it is an economic shot in the arm to go along with the vaccines that are rolling out now. There's certainly going to be more for the incoming Biden administration to do, but this will keep families and businesses afloat for a few more months and buy the new president and new Congress some time. Obviously, a lot of folks will be disappointed that the direct benefits are not going to be increased to $2,000 as the president wanted. But while that extra money would have been nice for a lot of people, it's not very well targeted. You know, a lot of it would have just sat in people's bank accounts because they can't travel right now or go to concerts or do lots of other things that they would ordinarily do with that money. We saw that with the last round of $1,200 payments that went out in the spring. So compared to other measures in this bill, like food stamps or unemployment benefits, or compared to things that aren't in the bill, like aid to cities and states, you know, direct payments just don't provide a whole lot of bang for the buck in terms of boosting the economy.
I want to turn back to you, Franco. Lawmakers are back this week. What are we watching for from them?
Well, it's going to be a busy week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to force a vote today on the $2,000 direct payments. She wants Republicans on record opposing it, something that Republican leaders really hope to avoid. In a statement after Trump signed the measure, Pelosi said a vote by Republicans against this bill is, quote, a vote to deny the financial hardships that families face. You know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell praised the signing in his own statement, but he didn't make any reference to any of the commitments referred to by the president. And Congress is also considering overriding Trump's veto of another spending bill on defense. And again, it's really unclear what Trump's going to do. He's just continuing to add to the chaos here at the end of the year.
Scott, what's the larger economic picture here?
Layla, this bill comes at a really critical time for the U.S. economy. We learned last week that personal income fell in November as earlier federal relief measures dried up. Personal spending fell last month as well, either because people couldn't afford to go out and spend money or because they were nervous about going out and spending money at a time when coronavirus infections are going through the roof. So the economy is really in a delicate place right now. This relief package will help. It is a life support system. It's unfortunate that it took so long for Congress to negotiate this package and so long for the president to sign it, but better late than never.
NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley and White House Correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Here in California, there is a battle going on between hospitals and the state's powerful nurses union. Because of a surge in hospitalizations, the state is asking nurses to take care of more patients than they normally would. That waters down a nurse-to-patient ratio law that so far exists only in California. From member station KQED, April Dembosky reports.
Normally, telemetry nurses take care of four patients at once. But since the governor relaxed the state's ratio law in mid-December, Narissa Black has to keep track of six.
We are given 50% more patients, and we're expected to do 50% more things with the same amount of time.
Her patients are sick. Many of them are in the hospital for a stroke or heart attack, and they have COVID. Black is terrified of missing something or making a mistake.
You know, I go home and I feel like I could have done more. Oh, I could have done this for them. I could have done that for them, but there just wasn't enough time.
In recent weeks, the state has excused 170 hospitals from the normal ratio rules, and nurses have taken to the streets in socially distant protests, like this one in San Bernardino. They accuse hospitals of putting profits over preparing for a surge, of laying nurses off over the summer, then not hiring enough for winter.
It seems that the hospitals have been more reactive than proactive in their staffing.
In California's current surge, four times as many people are testing positive for the virus compared to the summer. Up to 7,000 new patients could be coming to California hospitals every day. That's according to Carmela Coyle, the head of the state's hospital association. She says there's no way around the math.
We are simply out of nurses, out of doctors, out of respiratory therapists.
Coyle says hospitals have tried to hire contract nurses.
But because California surged early during the summer and other parts of the United States then surged afterwards, those travel nurses are taken.
Coyle says hospital's next step is to try team nursing, pulling nurses from the operating room, for example, to help with COVID patients. Economist Joanne Spetz studies the healthcare workforce at UC San Francisco. She says hospitals should have started training for this over the summer, but they didn't, either because of costs or excessive optimism.
California was doing so well, and that we kind of got it under control. And I think there was a lot of belief that we would be able to maintain that.
Spetz says the nurses union has reason to be defensive of the law that limits the number of patients nurses have to care for at one time. It took 10 years before it passed the legislature in 1999, then several more to clear the court challenges, including one from then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
At some rally where they were protesting, he made some offhand comment about kicking the nurses' butts.
Because I'm always kicking the butt. That's why they don't like me.
Which really hardened the opposition to him.
Nurses prevailed in the court of public opinion and law. But the battle has made them fiercely protective of patient ratios. They've even accused hospitals of using the pandemic to try to roll them back for good. Hospitals deny this, and Spetz says it's unlikely.
To go in and say, oh, you clearly did so well without ratios when we let you waive them, so let's just eliminate them entirely, I think would be just adding insult to moral injury to nurses.
The public can see that nurses are overworked and burned out by the pandemic. Spetz says hospitals probably wouldn't want to pick a fight with them over job protections once it's over. For NPR News, I'm April Dembosky in Oakland.
April's story is part of a partnership with NPR, Kaiser Health News, and KQED. We appreciate you listening to the program this morning on your public radio station, and stay in touch throughout the day. You can find us on social media, visit the Morning Edition Facebook page, and we are all over Twitter. You can find me at NPR Green. Noel King is at Noel King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR, and Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 19 past 8 now. 2020 was a pretty awful year on Earth, but in space, a year of remarkable achievements.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA. Go SpaceX.
More on space flights, missions, and studies from this year coming up in 15 minutes.
Celebrate the season with special programs all this month on WPR. Enjoy holiday tunes on Simply Folk, hear the Eau Claire Master Singers on Wisconsin Classical, and enjoy Christmas with the Moorhouse and Spelman Glee Clubs. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Transfer and Storage, specializing in machinery moving, with hauling capacity up to 85 tons and lift capacity up to 600 tons. Proud to be a WPR Business Cornerstone sponsor.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
A mix of sun and clouds in the forecast and a chance of flurries for central and northeast Wisconsin today. Mostly sunny for the rest of the state, highs from the low teens to mid-20s. And then a winter weather advisory and a winter storm watch will start Tuesday and last into Wednesday for much of western and south central Wisconsin. 4 to 5 inches of snow in the advisory area, 5 to 7 inches in the watch area, and highs on Tuesday from the upper teens to upper 20s.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Morgan Stanley, a proud sponsor of StoryCorps Connect, providing people with the ability to conduct a remote interview with loved ones at a distance at StoryCorpsConnect.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm David Green. As the U.S. draws down forces from Afghanistan, it is leaving behind a desperately poor country, and it's been made even poorer by this pandemic. The United Nations estimates that 3/4 of all Afghans are food insecure and going hungry. The situation for children under 5 is dire. Almost half are chronically malnourished and need nutritional support. NPR's Dia Hadid has more from Kabul.
Shaista is tricking her 8 children. They're home and she's boiling a pot of water on their wood-burning stove. But she's told them she's cooking dinner.
I tell them, wait for your father. He's coming. Then they fall asleep. I cry at night thinking of how I can't feed them.
Shaista says she's only got God to turn to.
God is kind. Maybe He will find a way for us.
Life has always been hard, but this year was the hardest. Shaista's husband was injured in an accident. Her oldest son, 15, began selling firewood. But there weren't many customers because the pandemic hit and Kabul shut down for weeks in the spring.
Corona made everything worse.
COVID has actually really accelerated a very difficult situation to begin with.
Melanie Galvin is the chief of nutrition in Afghanistan for UNICEF.
We have a huge number of children that are wasted. It's synonymous with starvation.
Some end up at the Indira Gandhi Hospital in Kabul. Outside, women in burqas clutch their swaddled babies as they wait to see a doctor. Inside, there's a department just for malnourished kids who've developed other complications. Hajit Izva is here with her granddaughter. Parvana's 18 months old. She keeps vomiting, but she's too weak to move on her cot, so the vomit dribbles down her neck and into her tattered tracksuit.
We didn't have enough to feed her. Sometimes we only have tea for 2 or 3 days. We don't even have bread.
Hajit Izva says money's scarce because her sons can't find work. To get to hospital, she had to borrow $8 for the taxi. That's a huge sum. Scenes like this are jarring, considering how much the US spent on the war in Afghanistan. Some $2 trillion, according to one study. Most of that spending was military-related, but billions were shelled out on development. So why are Afghans starving?
It's a million-dollar question, isn't it? Actually, it's a many-million-dollar question.
Heather Barr is from Human Rights Watch. She says for years, corruption sapped funds. Diplomats kept rotating in and out. They and the aid workers who were supposed to oversee the assistance largely stayed in their compounds for security reasons.
The cumulative effect of all that is pretty disastrous. You know, we have a country which has still got some of the worst development indicators in the world. after an extraordinary amount of money being spent.
Bar and aid workers say things have gotten more organised, although the international community is donating less. With the funding it does expect to get, UNICEF believes it will be able to treat a third of the children who need urgent help. This is Heather Barr again.
The international community is largely done with Afghanistan.
And that includes America.
There's just no realistic expectation that the US is going to remain interested in Afghanistan, ready to continue bankrolling Afghanistan's deeply financially dependent government.
Already, kids like Pravana, who are lucky enough to be treated, face an uncertain future. Her grandmother says when they go back home, Pravana will eat what the family eats. Often, that's nothing at all. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Kabul.
Tributes poured in when civil rights pioneer John Lewis died this summer. And after that, more enduring memorials took shape. In Rochester, New York, a group of artists recently finished a building-sized mural. Some of the city's residents had a big place in the late congressman's heart. James Brown from member station WXXI has the story.
Ephraim Gurbay relished the thought of making an enduring tribute to Lewis in Gurbay's hometown.
With his recent passing, I know it's devastated a lot of people. So we just wanted to kind of pay homage to him and his name and his legacy, and also, you know, bring Danny Lyon's image to life.
When I caught up with him and fellow artist Jared Diaz, they were climbing up and down scaffolding against the side of a building in downtown Rochester. They were outlining a 3,000-square-foot image of John Lewis, looking fierce in front of an audience in 1963. It's based on a photograph by Danny Lyon. It's called I Am Speaking, and it's the latest mural in their I Am series. Other murals are in Chicago and Louisville. For Diaz, the project is about showing people of color in powerful roles.
One thing I want them to see is people of color represented. People of color who've played meaningful roles in society represented. And for that to be permanent, and for them to see that done at the highest level possible.
What the artist didn't know is about Lewis's links to Rochester. Lewis was a close friend of the late Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. They met on their first day in Congress in 1986. Slaughter brought him to her district years before to meet some old friends, who Lewis said saved his life half a century ago. At Slaughter's memorial in 2018, Lewis recalled the meeting.
It was there. I met two nuns who had taken care of us when we were hurt in Selma, Alabama in 1965. They cried, they hugged me, I cried, and Louise cried.
In 1965, Lewis led hundreds of protesters in a march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. They were beaten so badly that the day became known as Bloody Sunday. He suffered a skull fracture. The nuns of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Rochester gave him first aid. That day, in the waves of marches that followed, are widely credited with the passing of the Voting Rights Act 5 months later. This giant portrait of Lewis now has a permanent place in Rochester's skyline, and it's very close to a statue of another civil rights pioneer. Just a block away, Frederick Douglass gave one of his most famous speeches, What to a Slave is the Fourth of July. For NPR News, I'm James Brown in Rochester, New York.
This is NPR News.
With coronavirus vaccinations underway, educators are already thinking about how to get kids back in classrooms and make up for all the lost ground.
We have decades of research showing that high-intensity tutoring can help students make up lost ground academically very quickly.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Plans to close the education gap this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Brady Carlson is your host for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. Coming up in our newscast, a look at what's been an unprecedented year for the Wisconsin National Guard. That story and more national, international, and state news coming up in our newscast just ahead here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. With the potential government shutdown looming, President Trump has signed the coronavirus relief package passed last week by Congress. The president signed the $900 billion measure as part of a broader spending bill, despite complaints that it doesn't provide enough direct relief to Americans. NPR's Jen Newman has more.
Unemployment benefits through pandemic relief programs, which lapsed on Saturday, will be restarted now that Trump has signed the bill. But Trump said in a statement Sunday night, the House will vote Monday on whether to increase payments to individuals from $600 to $2,000. The Democratic-led House supports the larger stimulus checks, but the Republican-led Senate has opposed it.
Lots of Americans have been traveling over the holidays, despite the CDC urging them not to because of the coronavirus. The TSA says it screened nearly 1.3 million airline passengers at the nation's airports yesterday. It's the highest number in the U.S. since the pandemic began. NPR's Jason Bobian says the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is urging Americans to avoid large crowds and parties on New Year's Eve.
Fauci, he was on CNN. He said we're at this critical moment. He said he's quite concerned that people getting together over the holidays is going to drive up the number of infections.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. This year marked the Wisconsin National Guard's largest sustained domestic mobilization in its history. They staffed polling places and helped COVID-19 community testing sites. Jenny Peek has more on this unprecedented year.
There's a warehouse in Madison full of N95 masks, coronavirus test kits, and other supplies the Wisconsin National Guard needs to respond to the pandemic. Warrant Officer Matt Hipp has managed the warehouse since June, taking supplies across the state from Milwaukee to Ashland. He's one of more than 1,600 troops involved in the state's fight against COVID-19.
We never envisioned to be part of a mission like this, but it's what the state needed. We were in an emergency, and who do you call when you're in an emergency? You call the National Guard.
The Guard has completed nearly 1 million COVID-19 tests. With a vaccine on the horizon, the Guard will adapt again, helping to distribute shots to Wisconsin citizens across the state. Jenny Peek, Wisconsin Public Radio.
New reports of COVID-19 cases are averaging around 2,000 cases per day in Wisconsin based on the latest data published by the State Department of Health Services. DHS reported 2,287 new cases of the disease Sunday, bringing the average for the past 7 days to 1,948 daily cases. 1 week ago, the average was 2,915 daily cases. There were 9 new deaths from COVID-19 reported on Sunday. Of the people who got tested for COVID-19 over the past week, 24.2% were positive for the disease, according to DHS. That rate has been declining since a spike following the Thanksgiving holiday. According to the Wisconsin Hospital Association, there were 1,081 COVID-19 patients hospitalized as of Sunday. A total of 4,692 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID-19. Over 470,000 have been infected. A mix of sun and clouds and a chance of flurries for central and northeast Wisconsin today. Mostly sunny for the rest of the state. Highs ranging from the low teens to mid-20s. On Tuesday, winter weather advisories and a winter storm watch will start and last into Wednesday for much of from western and south central Wisconsin. 4 to 5 inches of snow possible in the advisory area. The watch area could get 5 to 7 inches of snow, and we'll have highs from the upper teens to the upper 20s. It's WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Duolingo, a language learning app built around the idea that learning should be fun. With more than 34 languages, including endangered languages, Duolingo is available as an app for download. From Indeed, committed to helping businesses hire. When managers upgrade their job posts, they instantly get a list of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job criteria. More at indeed.com/credit. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm David Green. You know, 2020 has been a tough year for pretty much everybody on Earth. But things have been going much better off the planet, out in space. So to take a break from our terrestrial problems, we're going to talk about some of what happened this year in our solar system. We have NPR science correspondents Nell Greenfield-Boyce and Jeff Brumfield with us. Hello to you both.
Hi there.
Hey, David.
Well, let's talk space. I guess we should start with this big milestone for NASA and the big commercial company SpaceX.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA! Go SpaceX!
Right, so that was in May. SpaceX launched two NASA astronauts to the space station aboard their Dragon capsule. Jeff, you were watching that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had hoped to see it down in Florida, but like almost everyone else in the country, I ended up watching it in my basement with my kids. But that was actually really fun to do. And it was exciting because we've never really had a commercial company like SpaceX with control, sort of end-to-end control of a new spaceship like this. I mean, previous spaceships have been done in partnership with commercial companies, but this is really SpaceX's baby. And at the same time, there was an element of the routine to it because it went so smoothly. So, you know, this was a capsule, kind of like the Apollo capsules that sent astronauts to the moon in the 60s and 70s. Very tried and true technology, very well understood. And that's why it worked so well.
Well, and Nell, I mean, big moment for SpaceX, also a pretty big deal for NASA, right?
It was, because remember, we had been relying on Russia to get our astronauts up to the International Space Station for almost a decade. And it's not like it's every day there's a brand new spaceship for transporting people up into orbit. I mean, for the United States, the last time that happened was the Space Shuttle's first flight all the way back in 1981. And this means NASA can let commercial companies handle kind of the domestic flights to low Earth orbit. You know, SpaceX can have a taxi service up and down to the station, and that frees up NASA to focus on deep space exploration, you know, getting back to the moon, for example.
I love the idea of a taxi service to space. Well, I guess this was also a pretty important year for bringing souvenirs back from the solar system, right? I mean, there were a couple of these missions that actually scooped up samples, brought them home. Jeff, I guess let's start with that Chinese mission to the moon.
Yeah, so this mission is called Chang'e 5. It scooped up a sample from the lunar surface, and this is the first time that's been done in over 40 years. And it basically looked like a little robotic version of the Apollo missions of the 1960s and 70s. So the spacecraft took off, it flew to the moon, it sent down a lander. The lander got that sample, rocketed back up to a service module, and returned to Earth. And the fact that it went so smoothly for China is just a really big win for them geopolitically. In fact, only two other countries have brought back moon samples, the U.S. and Russia. So this now puts China in that very top tier of spacefaring nations.
Well, and Nell, I understand asteroids were also a pretty popular destination.
Yeah, so Japan had a mission to an asteroid that launched 6 years ago. You know, it went out to the asteroid, got a little bit of pebbles, and then came home finally just, you know, this month in December. This was the biggest sample of an asteroid ever returned. Now, you know, big is relative here. It was only about 5 grams of dust and rock. Meanwhile, NASA did its own asteroid sample collection, the first one for NASA, and it got so many rocks, they overstuffed their collection device. In the end, they're not sure how much they got, but it looks like hundreds of grams. And, you know, they'll find out when it returns in 2023.
Why go through all that trouble? I mean, why do scientists so badly want these pieces of asteroids?
Asteroids are thought to be sort of like leftover pieces from the stuff that made our solar system. They're like these pristine, you know, sort of building blocks that have been unperturbed for billions of years. And so it'll let people learn a lot about the history of the solar system that produced planets such as us. But also, you know, asteroids might someday hit us and like take out a city. So scientists really want to understand more about them to essentially protect the planet.
Yeah, whatever clues we can get to avoid that happening. Well, let's look ahead to 2021. What are both of you looking for that, you know, might take place out of this world?
Well, it's going to be a big year for Mars. There are already 3 missions that are set to arrive at the Red Planet in February, a U.S. and a Chinese rover, and then a orbiter from the United Arab Emirates. So that's going to be a big deal.
The other thing I'm looking forward to is NASA is planning to launch a huge new space telescope. It's sort of supposed to be the successor to Hubble, and it's been long delayed, really long delayed. But it should give us some great views of the universe, assuming it actually launches in October as they plan.
All right. Sounds pretty cool. Nell Greenfield-Boyce and Jeff Brumfield from NPR's science team, thank you both so much, and have a good new year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Dealing with isolation has been really tough on World War II vet Martin Adler. So his daughter, Rochelle Donnelly, posted a picture to a World War II Facebook group.
It's a photo of my dad with a great big smile, and there are three children sitting in front of him.
So when we spoke with Donnelly yesterday, she said she thought a reunion would cheer up her dad. The photograph was taken in 1944 in a small central Italian town. Adler was 20 years old.
He was fighting to liberate the area. Adler and another soldier had entered a small stone house armed with machine guns, trying to track down German snipers.
One of the baskets, big baskets, that they keep wine bottles in, began to move. I said, "Venti qui, in Italian. Come here, come here." And out popped three children, crying, scared stiff.
He and his fellow soldier were so relieved, they asked their mother if they could take a photo. And Adler still gets emotional when he talks about this picture.
It brings back great memories when we were expecting Germans to pop out. Instead, three beautiful kids pop out.
Italian journalist Matteo Incerti saw the photo and shared it on social media. Not long after, Martin was meeting the kids in the photograph, virtually, on Italian TV.
The three Naldi siblings are now in their 70s and 80s. The story went viral in Italy, which has been hit so hard by this pandemic. Incerti says it came at a good time.
Even if in terrible moment, we have to find the magic of life.
Ciao, Martin. Quando ho visto la foto, mi sono riconosciuto subito.
Bruno Naldi, the older boy in the photo, doesn't really remember the encounter, but he says he recognized himself in the picture. Adler remembers the day vividly.
I would love to go back to Italy and see them and hug them like we hugged them that day.
Incerti is planning a reunion when it's safe to travel again. This is NPR News.
Good morning, and thanks for listening today. It is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and some poetry coming up on the program. In her debut collection, poet Torin A. Greathouse explores what it means to be both trans and disabled and the ways beauty can be a trap for trans women. In 9 minutes, more on the collection, which is titled Wound from the Mouth of a Wound.
WPR has been a radio pioneer for more than 100 years. Today, listener support is the largest source of funding. As a donor, you can be proud of the history you've created. Thanks to you, WPR's future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, and great discussions. Continue the spirit of innovation. Make your year-end gift now at WPR.org, and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about 4imprint's dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
Support comes from UW Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu.
Here are some of today's stories. A moderate earthquake has hit central Croatia near its capital of Zagreb, triggering panic and some damage south of the city. There were no immediate reports of injuries. Croatia's seismologist said the magnitude of the quake that struck around 6:30 a.m. local time was 5.0. The same area was also hit by a strong quake on March 22nd, which killed one person and caused substantial damage in Zagreb and its surrounding areas. Federal officials now turn to the monumental task of piecing together the motive behind the Christmas Day explosion that severely damaged dozens of downtown Nashville buildings and injured three people. Officials have named 63-year-old Anthony Quinn Warner as the man behind the mysterious explosion in which he was killed. His motive has remained elusive. Stay tuned. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR coming up in 15 minutes. And there's always more news available on our website. That's WPR.org. It's 8:45.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil Night Pain, a nighttime pain reliever designed to help people fall asleep fast. It contains diphenhydramine and acetaminophen. More at ZzzQuil.com. And from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A group of Catholic peace activists are being sent to prison. That's because they broke into a U.S. Navy base to stage a protest against nuclear weapons. NPR's Emma Peasley spoke with some of them and their families before their sentences begin.
You want to go higher?
Yeah!
All right.
A white-haired man wearing a black beret pushes a girl on a swing at a playground in Gardner, North Carolina. The swing is for children with special needs.
All right, hold on. Hold on, girl. So when Mary Evelyn was little, you know, because she has Down syndrome, she used to go on them then before she got good at riding the regular swings, but she still likes them.
They seem comfier.
Yes, this is the Cadillac of swings.
Patrick O'Neill is the father of eight, a devout Catholic, a hospital chaplain, and in less than a month, he's going to prison. In 2018, he and six other protesters cut through a fence at the nuclear naval submarine base Kings Bay in Georgia. They poured their own blood on the base logo and attached a poster of Martin Luther King Jr. to a towering replica of a Trident ballistic missile. The protesters are part of a faith-based movement known as the Plowshares that in the past have done actual damage to military armaments.
People are always astounded that a bunch of old people can gain access to these weapons at all.
The youngest member of the group is in his late 50s, and the oldest is 81. Their name comes from the verse in scripture that talks about beating swords into plowshares. So they took a hammer and tried to damage the statue of the missile. That sound is from the video they took while stealing across the base. O'Neill says they passed through a restricted area where a loudspeaker played a warning.
It was creepy. Deadly force is authorized. Deadly force is authorized. Hearing it dozens of times, deadly force is authorized.
The group was arrested and O'Neill sentenced to 14 months in prison. The others have so far been given terms of up to 33 months.
Yes, this will be my longest prison sentence.
Martha Hennessy has already been in prison three times. She's the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, who founded the anti-war Catholic worker movement in the 1930s. Hennessy is now in prison in Danbury, Connecticut. When we spoke a few weeks ago, she was still at home, preferring to talk about the injustices she sees in mass incarceration.
I'm looking at serving 8 months at this point in time, which is really nothing. There are people being thrown into prison for years for, things that are not even crimes.
Many of the plowshares talk about prison this way, but their families are worried.
I'm afraid that my dad might die in prison.
Maura O'Neill is another of Patrick O'Neill's children.
I worry that he might contract COVID and get really sick. It feels like a real possibility.
But in these last weeks, before Patrick O'Neill's sentence begins, the family is making the most of their time with him. Like 15-year-old Mary Evelyn did that afternoon on the playground.
This is the fun day ever!
Emma Peasley, NPR News, Gardner, North Carolina.
Stop trying to hit me.
Later on All Things Considered, a conversation with former Education Secretary John King Jr. He talks about what school districts are going to have to do to recover from the setbacks from the pandemic. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, about 10 minutes before 9 now. Classical music coming up after news from NPR and WPR with Peter Bryant sitting in for Stephanie Alkins.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. /maps.
In sports, Devontae Adams caught three of Aaron Rodgers' four touchdown passes as the Green Bay Packers trounced the Tennessee Titans 40-14 for their fifth consecutive victory. The Packers already have clinched the NFC North title. They can earn the number one seed in the NFC playoffs if they win at Chicago or if Seattle loses at San Francisco next week. The Bucks lost to the Knicks 130-110 yesterday, and the Wisconsin men's basketball team is scheduled to play Rutgers today at 6. In weather, a mix of sun and clouds and a chance of flurries for central and northeast Wisconsin today. Mostly sunny for the rest of the state. Highs ranging from the low teens to the mid-20s. And then winter weather advisories and a winter storm watch will start on Tuesday and last into Wednesday for much of western and south central Wisconsin. 4 to 5 inches of snow in the advisory area. The watch area could get 5 to 7 inches. Highs from the upper teens to the upper 20s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Leila Faldin. What does it mean to be beautiful as a trans and disabled woman? That's a question that poet Torin Greathouse explores in a debut collection of poems. It's called Wound, From the Mouth of a Wound.
Once I searched for softness on my tongue, ground my father's anger, sour mash cavities for my teeth. I just wanted to talk pretty enough to be mistaken for what I was. Hot flush of girlish blood. I edited all my ugly out. Made a perfect poem of my soft and lacquered mouth. Now I'm looking for the ugly of my tongue. Lolling serpent curled in the slick of my jaw, searching for its own teeth.
That is Greathouse, who lives in Minneapolis, reading an excerpt from their poem that's titled An Ugly Poem. It explores how beauty for trans women is a double bind.
There is a very large cultural imperative to be beautiful and presentable in a very specific way, and it's kind of a trap.
Greathouse says trans women are expected to be feminine, but only up to a point.
If we're not feminine enough, that is a failure. But if trans women are too feminine, then that is also seen as a flaw. It is seen as being a caricature of womanhood.
So in their book, Greathouse wanted to question the tendency poets have to only lean towards beauty.
What does it mean to not write towards beauty as a trans woman, but to write towards ugliness?
The poet examines this by deliberately placing what is considered ugly or taboo right next to pure and intimate joy.
One thing for me that is important is this book existing as a signpost that it is possible to be and move in the world as someone who is trans, who is disabled.
And by reading this body of poems, Greathouse hopes readers will feel less lonely.
All right, for this next story, I actually need to do an important handoff to one of our other co-hosts, Rachel Martin.
Hi, David. Hi. We're doing this because you're leaving NPR. You're moving on to a new chapter.
I am, and I'm not totally ready to talk about any of that yet because we're going to have time to say goodbyes on the show tomorrow.
Totally.
But I do want to talk to you about this project we've been doing, the Morning Edition Song Project, which you are going to be taking over, and that makes me very happy.
Yes, I am super excited about what you have done in this project along with our producer, Vince Pearson. It's just been such a great series.
Yeah, I mean, Vince deserves the bulk of the credit for this. I mean, he's just produced something that's been really special. And this is just a taste of what it sounded like.
Can't work a J-O-B, so why we getting charged fees like it's the same old thing? Man, I wish I saw it coming like ESP. I'm trying to see the other side of COVID-19.
That song is actually called Quarantined, and it's a song that the rapper Chris Styles Bacon wrote for us for this project. He's one of the 13 artists who wrote in these episodes that have been airing every 2 weeks on the program. And these musicians, they followed the news from the initial lockdowns in the pandemic to the protests to the economic collapse in our country. And I don't know, it's just felt very poetic and really engaging emotionally.
Totally. A different way to make sense of everything happening around us. Can you just remind us how the whole thing got started?
Well, I mean, if you remember back, like, we were doing these pieces about how pandemics in the past inspired and influenced art. So Vince and I were talking, I mean, maybe there's a way that someone could write a song about what we were living through in 2020, in the moment. And that's when we were talking to Ketch Secor. He's the lead musician in Old Crow Medicine Show. We didn't know exactly what to expect if we asked him to do this, but he was totally into it. Here he is talking about the song that he wrote for us. It was the first one that we aired. It was called Pray for America.
We as songwriters, we got to keep adding to the canon of songs about America because we need to update it. These are troubling times and we need new songs about our country to inspire unity.
When sorrows are befalling, in shadows darken her door. When the fever spreads and a silent scourge outshines the golden shores.
I love that. I mean, it was just basically your thesis statement for the whole project, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it just gave us the template and the message that we've been trying to capture. And what made me nervous, though, is we had asked him to write that song in May, before George Floyd was murdered, before the protests that came to define so much of the year. And we were getting ready to interview him about the song after Floyd was killed. And I'm thinking, like, maybe the song's not going to work anymore. But we realized that that could be part of the conversation. And so I asked Ketch about that and asked him if it still worked.
When you write music, you're trying to make universal statements. Great songs like Blowing in the Wind, they're not about particular vantage points. They're not about any particular side or affiliation. Great songs are there for all to enjoy and for all to see themselves in. So writing a song about COVID-19, if it's any good, it ought to be able to translate from a global pandemic to a cry for justice.
Pray for America, our promised land.
Yeah, and I remember, even though the song didn't directly touch on race in America, your conversation did, because Ketch had a black bandmate who had a lot to say about his own experiences with racism in Nashville, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's when it brought it all home. It was a discussion about song craft, but also, you know, really intimate and personal conversation about what was taking place around us.
What was it like to try to get other artists involved?
It turned out not to be nearly as hard as we expected. You know, I think a lot of artists were just really inspired by the drama of everything happening in 2020. But, you know, there's also the fact that live performances were shut down. And I think a lot of artists just love the fact that there was this other avenue for expression.
It was such a diverse group of musicians, right? Some uber famous, others were up and comers. Was there one that stood out for you just personally?
The Indigo Girls was pretty special.
Yeah.
This was apparently the first time they had written a song together in nearly 25 years.
No food to eat, an epidemic of inequality, and a pandemic raging.
Well, this has been an amazing project. It has been so fun just on a personal level to hear you in these conversations. You care so much about music and the story behind it. Thank you for doing it.
Well, keep it going. I'm excited to see who you bring on and how people try and make sense of 2021.
Yeah, we'll do it. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Rachel. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. And it's going to be really tough to say goodbye to David Green tomorrow. Wow. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. News updates from NPR and WPR every hour for you, as well as news on our website at WPR.org. Right now it's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
Support comes from Gateway. The new semester begins January 19th. Although Student Services is closed through the holidays, browse the program catalog and register online now. Starting January 4th, career counselors will be available via phone, email, online chat, or Zoom. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.